So I'm at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and assistant professor there. There are no relationships to disclose. I'd like to acknowledge Daria Mueller, who was a doctoral student at UWM, who also helped me with the analysis. So I'm talking, I titled it New Kids on the Block, partly because it is a new court that is emerging. This really came out of the problem-solving specialty courts. So the first ones were the drug courts that were created in the 1990s. And that was really around the height of the crack cocaine epidemic, that we were spending an excessive amount of money on the criminal justice system, locking people up, and decided that we needed to have a different response. So the response was the drug court that was created. And the intent behind that was to really begin to deal with some of the underlying causes and the reasons that brought individuals into the system and really provide them with the tools to change their lives. So again, in 1991, we have 5 drug courts. In 2009, we have almost 2,500 different types of specialty courts. And so this approach is taken off and as being applied to many different problems. I think the benefit of this is that it really tries to provide a non-adversarial approach. And so again, the traditional criminal justice system is sort of, you know, very punitive, lock them up, just kind of very adversarial. And so just really trying to change that, again, providing individuals with a continuum of services. It is judicially supervised, or they have some interactions with the judge. Many of the research that has been found that who these kinds of courts work for are, again, more of the chronic individuals that are struggling with addictions and other kinds of issues, and that have failed other types of treatment or supervisory interventions. Again, prostitution court is one of the newest courts. There are about 14 courts nationwide. They're in 9 different states. There's 8 adult prostitution court-based programs also. So again, there's not that many. There are more popping up every day, and part of this really came out of Texas actually created a law that any county that had 200,000 people or more had to have a kind of prostitution program, court, something of that kind. Prostitution courts, I think, are a little bit different than other types of specialty courts in that they're really trying to get to some of the underlying root causes, contributing factors that related to prostitution. So I'll talk a lot about that. Again, this is a new approach that this is a high recidivism. Women who have histories of prostitution have a high recidivism rate. It's called the revolving door effect, that basically women are arrested, they come in, they may, you know, do their time, they may get a fine at first, and they go out and they get rearrested. And so the judge who started the prostitution court that I'm going to talk about said that he really started it because he kept seeing the same women in his court over and over and over again, and nothing was being done. And so we weren't dealing with, you know, sort of the reasons that kept bringing them back in. And so he decided to start the prostitution court for that reason. And so the idea is that prostitution court links participants to much needed services, substance abuse treatment, housing, medication. Many of the services that I think had these women not been involved in a court like this would not have had access to. And again, it's an alternative to jail. But you know, one of the things that, you know, I'll talk about in some of the findings is that, you know, there's this real push to still hold people accountable. So there's, you know, when you're talking about criminal justice, we can't be too soft on these women. We still gotta hold them accountable. And so there's still that, you know, that balancing act that has to happen. there's different kinds of courts, and so I just put them in, so they're pre-adjudication or diversion kinds of programs. And so I think Dr. Chen talked about the one where, you know, basically that you participate and your record is essentially wiped clean, or it's not, doesn't go on your record. Then there's post-adjudication courts, which are sort of the back end. You often have to plead guilty. You often remain under supervision for a period of time afterwards. And again, there's typically your record is not cleaned. And so the RISE program is a post-adjudication program. It's called RISE, Reaching Independence Through Self-Empowerment. And so that's what the acronym stands for. It is a 2 to 3 year program, which is rare. Most of the prostitution court programs do not last this long. Again, post-adjudication, many of the women who were involved with RISE were facing anywhere from 3 to 10 years. Texas, again, is a unique state in that they're, generally speaking, on the laws, again, we're talking about a lot of charges over and over and over again, but you could get up to 20 years in jail for just prostitution. So, you know, this court was created for that. Again, the goal was really to try to help women to reach their full potential and to exit a life of prostitution. So this is kind of the process that one goes through. Again, they don't come to RISE until they're arrested. So they're arrested in a sweep, or, you know, a sting operation or something like that happens. And then they're referred to the RISE program. So they can be referred by their defense attorney. They can be referred by, the judge can refer them. You know, a social worker, any professional that's working with them or comes into contact with them can say, hey, have you heard about the RISE program, and refer them to that. An assessment is typically done, and that's done in while they're in jail. So kind of a full workup, psychological evaluation, medications, health issues that, you know, need addressing, or those kinds of things are done. Again, like I said, with post-adjudication, a plea has to be made, and then, you know, there's a series of things that happen. She has to, the woman has to agree to participate in the program, has to write a brief kind of history, has to take some other, you know, administrative things that have to happen, and then basically voluntarily chooses to be a part of this program. Once she agrees, then some kind of substance abuse treatment program. So 30, 60, 90 days treatment, depending on the severity of her substance abuse. Then supervision supervision or probation. Also, there's all probation and supervision is always involved. So she leaves jail, goes to treatment. After treatment, then is placed in housing. And there were several partners that worked with around housing. Again, that's when the counseling, mental health treatment starts happening, NA, AA, those kinds of things, kind of moves through the program. The end goal is that they end up in their own apartments, job, on medication, all of those things. So that's sort of the process over the 3 years. Eligibility criteria, she has to be female. There were a couple of men who, you know, technically, other than gender, would have qualified. The judge decided not to let them into the program because he wanted, this was new, he wanted to kind of get it right with women and then figure out the men kind of things. So again, extensive prostitution related history. Women with 3G offenses, which typically are violent offenses, were not allowed to participate in the RISE program. Again, there were some exceptions to that, particularly if the violence was, again, against a perpetrator or a client who had done something. There were some exceptions made in those cases. Again, Tarrant County jurisdiction, minor health problems. I'll talk about some of that. A couple of the women had were diagnosed with HIV/AIDS, but the court, several women were turned away because of significant health issues, and I'll talk about some of that. And then just kind of extensive or long time offender. So I talked about kind of the acceptance process. The judge kind of has the final say as to who gets into the program. So the purpose of this study was really to start to understand more about prostitution courts. Again, there's a lot written on drug courts. There's a lot written on the kind of the factors that go into drug courts, or the essential factors that should be a part of drug courts, and sort of the outcomes of drug courts. But there's not a lot written on prostitution courts, and that's just because they're relatively new. And so I really wanted to kind of think about, you know, what are those factors? How are they different than drug courts? And really start to tease apart, you know, to look at that. So again, the existing studies, there were about 11 studies around prostitution courts. And so again, most of them have focused on the pre-adjudication of prostitution courts. They also focus on participants' sort of perceptions and experiences of those programs, and then kind of the strengths and limitations of prostitution diversion courts. But again, there's not a lot of studies that focus on the back end or the post-adjudication courts, and that's partly because there's not a lot of post-adjudication prostitution courts. But I really wanted to understand the strengths and challenges that these prostitution courts have, especially in light of the fact that so many more were going to be popping up, particularly in Texas, with the new law. I used a case study design. I'm a qualitative researcher. And so, you know, basically from March 2012 to July 2013, I was at the court. They meet on a bi-monthly basis. And so on a, you know, every, you know, second and fourth Wednesday from pretty much the whole morning, there's the stakeholders that meet and review kind of the women over the last 2 weeks, review the cases, any things that have been happening with the women. So the housing people are there, the mental health people, nurse, public health, everybody comes together for those team meetings. And so I was a part of those meetings. And then after that meeting, and things are just kind of decided, particularly sanctions and those kinds of things, then the women come in for the docket. So I stayed for that part as well. So women participating at that time, it was small, as 14 women. Now they have increased their numbers up to 30 women. But at the time, it was 14 women who had been in the program. None of them had graduated at that point. And then 8 service providers I was able to talk to. So what are the factors that facilitate and hinder the successful implementation of prostitution courts such as RISE, was my research question. So I did 22 in-depth semi-structured interviews. Again, they lasted 1 to 2 hours, audio recorded, transcribed those. Again, 16 months of observation. Every, you know, 2 weeks I was there taking notes, just being a fly on the wall. Listening to, you know, a lot of things that were happening and a lot of things were going on, which was really hard for me to just listen and not say things, but I'll talk a little bit about that. And then documents. So I got to review the women's files, the case dockets, all of those kinds of things. Again, the women we were talking about, age 25 to 55 years old, on average about 43. They had been in the program for anywhere from 2 months to 3 years at this point. 5 women were African American, 9 were white. 12 of the 14 were reported having bipolar mental health disorder. 8 of the 12 women also had another diagnosis, which was typically depression, anxiety, and or PTSD. All of them had substance abuse issues. In terms of entry into prostitution, 3 of the women began prostituting to support their drug habit. 3 women began using after they started to kind of engage in prostitution. 2 women began prostituting through strip clubs, and then 4 women were introduced to prostitution by family members, boyfriends, friends. the type of prostitution, again, most participated in street-based prostitution. There were a couple that talked about escort, online, indoor kinds of things, and four women reported having a pimp at one time or another. Again, amongst these women, teen pregnancy was very common, dropping out of high school, running away. So I'm going to move forward. Again, trauma, like all of the many of the presenters talked about, a lot of trauma. Not one of all of them had experienced some trauma. Like I said, 8 women, 57% experienced from 4 to 7 different traumatic events. 43%, 8 to 11. And this is some of the things. Again, sexual abuse as a child is very common. And again, I don't know exactly what it is about that particularly, but I think that that makes them more vulnerable to prostitution. And I know that several of the women I interviewed talked about the fact that, you know, well, she said, I was giving it away for free, now I'm charging for it. So again, have an issue with, she wasn't giving it away, it was being taken from her. But again, there's something about awakening your sexual identity at a young age that I think makes them more vulnerable to prostitution. I'm move quickly, I'm sorry, I've got 5 minutes here. So just in terms of analysis, again, I Axel quoted line by line, went through all of those interviews, did some triangulation in terms of that I had, you know, I interviewed many of the stakeholders about some of the women and, you know, had sort of both sides of the story, if you will, thematic analysis. So in terms of what I found, that there were political partnerships, programmatic and personal kind of investment strengths and challenges. And so each of those challenges were, you know, I really talk about that in depth in the paper. I think the most relevant finding was just that, again, stigma associated with prostitution. It comes out in the professionals' attitudes towards women. I think we saw it in the political realm in terms of these women being undeserving and really, you know, a lot of people, a lot of proponents, still feeling like, why do we even need a prostitution court? They chose this life, you know, they kind of get what they deserve. And so Judge Carr had to constantly were bumping up against this political, you know, force that was very anti-women who had histories of prostitution. And so I think that, again, that's, you know, sort of a real issue. I think even the workers and people who are working with them, that their feelings about these women kind of come out in how they treat them, how they talk to them, those kinds of things. I think that another thing is that many of these women were older. Again, much older than I expected them to be. We're talking about 10 of these women were over 42 years old. The oldest was 56. So again, we're talking about an older group of women. With that comes, again, high levels of trauma. So we're talking about not only, you know, this woman 20, but we're talking about this woman is, you know, talking about childhood stuff, and then, you know, in many cases had been out on the streets a very long time. We're talking about many, many different kinds of events. We're talking about significant health challenges that many of these women face. So, like I said, HIV, chronic CPOD, one of the women had, brain injury, damage, you know, a couple of the women had been beaten and cut. They're in, showed me the scar, you know, across their head or whatever. And so we're talking a lot of physical disabilities. A couple of them had, like, canes walking. And so you're thinking, like, who is, you know, well, who, it was just really fascinating. I think, again, surprisingly, 12 of the 14 had diagnosed with bipolar. Again, as a clinician, I'm thinking that's, it was just striking to me that bipolar was that high. Well, what I realized was that the program that was evaluating these women were not receiving funds for, were only receiving funds for high or serious mental illness. that they weren't receiving funds for depression and anxiety, which were more common. So again, in order to qualify these women for services, they had to be labeled as bipolar. But again, what does that do? You know, the medications that women are on, you know, the implications for that. Again, surprisingly, housing was the biggest need and the hardest to provide. And so again, we're talking about this, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of need, that if we're wanting to help women to exit prostitution, housing has to be a part of that. Employment, again, one of the issues is that, and I think Dr. Chin talked about this, that, you know, these women have very little options. They have serious criminal history records. They, again, most of them have no college experience, have dropped out of high school. Their options are very limited. And so I found that, again, relapse and kind of going back to the streets is really an issue for these women, because when I need money, what do I do? And so that becomes an issue. In terms of the findings, that five women have graduated now, five women are, you know, set to graduate, five women have jobs, so they became beauticians, construction office assistant. They were able to get into the programs, and again, partly because the judge had these relationships and were developing these relationships with employers that were willing to take a chance on some of these women. They were able to help them get into school, and that was, you know, one of the benefits of this. Again, the RISE program, you know, it's not without its challenges. It's not without its problems. I think, you know, ideally I would love for these women to not have to be in a court like this at all, and to be able to have access to these services. But until we can create a social service infrastructure that is able to, you know, serve these women,